Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we chat to inspiring women who help us to think differently and maybe even change our day. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Kate Moss. Hello and welcome, Kate.
Hello, lovely to be here. Well, here and you there, but lovely to be talking to you.
Oh, and you. And are you in France or England?
No, I'm in home in England, where we've been all the lockdown in Chichester in West Sussex. But it's been lovely, actually, really peaceful. You know, we're very lucky. We've got lots of space, fields close by and the sea and all of those things. So nothing at all to complain about.
Now, Kate Moss is a number one best-selling novelist of historical fiction, gothic fiction, plays and the stage, and the founder director of the Women's Prize for Fiction, the largest annual celebration of women's writing in the world, and sits on the executive committee of Women of the World. So, Kate, you do an awful lot to help and support women, and I will ask you about that in a minute, actually. But we'll go straight into your new series of historical adventure novels. And The Burning Chambers went to the top of the charts in the UK charts and abroad. So everyone loves your books. Do you want to just describe The Burning Chambers for me?
The Burning Chambers is a sequence, actually, of four books. I worked out that if I was to do it in three, everybody would have to live to be about 190. So we needed to add another one on the end. But The Burning Chambers series covers 300 years of history. It's a Romeo and Juliet story, if you like, a Catholic family, a Huguenot family, which is what French Protestants were known as. And it starts in 1562 in Carcassonne on the eve of the wars of religion that will destroy France. And it travels from Carcassonne to Toulouse, to Paris, to Amsterdam, to the Canary Islands, and finally to the Cape of Good Hope and Franschhoek in South Africa. And it is a story of missing relics. It's a story of a feud between these two families that will last for 300 years and put a shadow over all their descendants. And I got the idea from it, rather than in Carcassonne, as usual, for me, being in Franschhoek in South Africa. And I suddenly had this sense of what would it be like to tell a refugee story. All refugee stories, if you like, are sad because they're about loss and displacement and injustice and being driven from the home you love. But when I was standing in Franschhoek in South Africa, which is in the Wineland district of the Western Cape, and looking up at the Franschhoek Mountains, I thought, you know, these mountains are very like the mountains of Southwest France. And what about if you had grown up hearing about this place that had been stolen from you because of the wars of religion 300 years ago, but you found yourself on the other side of the world and suddenly realized that you could call this place home? And then, of course, once I'd got the idea, it was, okay, I better go back to the beginning. And where do all my historical novels start?
Oh, wow. I love the way you describe that, actually. And it's lovely to know how your sort of magic and story actually comes to you, because it obviously is a, you know, a feeling, and it's a presence of where your stage is set, really, isn't it? It's amazing.
For me, landscape is, in a way, the biggest character. Everything, all of my stories are inspired by place first. That sense that because you are in this particular place, a particular story can be told. I couldn't pick up my stories and just set them somewhere else. Wow. So the landscape and the plotting and the storytelling are inextricably linked right from the get-go. And I'm a playwright as well. And I realize that that's how I think of my novels, is that the research and the landscape and, you know, the years of research I put into the historical detail, but also the landscape, is about building the stage set. And once it's built, like in a theatre, the actors can come and join me. But until it's built, there's nowhere for them to play.
Gosh, that's brilliant to know. And so inspiring for, you know, budding novelists, hopefully, who will come out after lockdown. So you've described it beautifully, as you said, set in 16th century Languedoc, love and betrayal, mysteries and secrets of war and adventure. And your love of Carcassonne, because you have a home there as well, you lucky thing. And the weather's like Carcassonne now, isn't it? So you've always had a love of France, and that's where a lot of your stories come from too.
It's one of those things, I think, when you're lucky enough to become a full-time writer and that your actual job, which is what happened to me when I was not till I was 45, but you know, it happened then. It's that sense of why did it happen? And for me, it happened because we went to Carcassonne, not because I'd always had a love affair with France. My knowledge of France was very limited to northern France. I live in Sussex, grew up in Sussex, born and bred, Chichester born and bred. And we are twinned here with the cathedral city of Chartres. And so all of my earliest trips were either camping holidays to Brittany with my family or orchestra trips or school trips to Chartres. And so, you know, it was very specific. And Chartres appears in the second in my sequence of Burning Chamber series, which is called The City of Tears, which will be out in January. And of course, it appeared in my first big seller, Labyrinth. And again, it's that same idea that that was a city I knew well. But we only were in Carcassonne by accident. My mother-in-law, wonderful mother-in-law, for whom I'm a carer and lives with us here in Sussex, she's nearly 90 now. But when she retired from teaching, she worked in the local school for mentally and physically disabled young people. She had a tiny lump sum, and we pooled our very tiny resources, and we thought we'd buy a place in France. My husband, who grew up here too in Chichester, had gone to Paris after university and had discovered he really should have been French. And so his love affair was with Paris. And so we bought this tiny house only because my mother-in-law had a friend who had a friend who had a friend who had a friend who was an estate agent who was twinned with an estate agent in this place called Carcassonne that we had never heard of. So we got off the train in those days, 30 years ago now, and I was expecting our first child, so it was very waddly. I knew nothing about Carcassonne, and we walked through the modern town, the Bastide, which is 14th century, which is where much of the Burning Chambers is set. And it was misty and it was cold, it was November, and we walked to the Pont Vieux, the old bridge, which links the Bastide to the medieval city on the hill. And I saw this extraordinary crown of stone, 52 towers and turrets, two rings of walls, all floodlit in the sort of cold November night. And that was it. I just fell head over heels in love.
I love the way you describe it. You know, that's a story in itself. It's just like being told a story, isn't it?
It was. I didn't intend to write about it. But over the next few years, you know, we had our daughter and then we had our son. And we spent 4 or 5 months there in this same tiny little house in the shadow of the medieval city walls. You know, one room downstairs and two tiny bedrooms upstairs. And we had to put in a bathroom and a kit. You know, it was that sort of place. And we still go there, you know, from time to time. But it was being there little by little. For me, the way I think about it is, it's the voices in the landscape. I could hear that there was a story coming for me. And it took a long time before I wrote, and it started to research the history of the Cathars in the same way that in the Burning Chamber series, it's the history of the Huguenots. But it's very much all, the anchor is Carcassonne and my love affair with that. So all of my historical fiction are basically love letters.
And you love history as well. Did you love history at school?
I loved history at school. And I would have done history at university, except in those days, the place I wanted to go, you had to have a modern language A level. And hilariously, I had Latin.
And inspiring to women, and with all your work that you do with women, and incredibly champion women, you know, as we do, to know that actually you were 45 when this sort of came to you as a second career, really, with children and everything. So that's hope for others too, isn't it? It's wonderful.
Well, I think that there is such a pressure on women, and actually on all young people, but I still think the pressures are bigger on women and girls. The idea that by 16, you're supposed to know everything, you're supposed to know what you want to do for the rest of your life. And the idea, which is linked to a very old-fashioned idea of work, which no longer exists, the idea that you find your career and you start it and you do that till you retire. That was always a male career path anyway, and jobs for life don't exist anymore. But everybody's still got that emotionally in their mind. Whereas I think what, particularly for women's careers and lives, what we should be thinking about is, if you're lucky enough to be in a position to do it, do something that fulfills you and works with your other responsibilities and makes you feel you're doing some good in the world and good for yourself and all of these things. And then you can stop and do something else. It's fine to do more than one thing. And I think this is so important for women, because most women have some sort of career break if they choose to have children or are lucky enough to have children if they want them. And many people are in the position that I am in. For 10 years, I've been a carer, and that radically changed my working life. I didn't have to change my working life as much as many people would, because I work at home. So it was much easier for me to do it. But in terms of being able to travel to Carcassonne, that isn't something we can do anymore.
And with lockdown and everything happening at the moment, I know it's... So we're all in lockdown. Actually, being creative is a brilliant thing. You mentioned your next novel, City of Tears, is coming out in the UK and US January 2021. So you've already got your life sorted for 2021 and beyond with your, you know, third and fourth, and none of us have. So does that give you structure of knowing the future? pressure, I suppose it must do.
It's an odd thing. And again, I think it's terribly important to always keep reminding ourselves of the things that are lucky in our lives compared to the things that aren't. And for many people for whom the lockdown, particularly women, has been very, very challenging indeed. And I think many of us who have always been our definition of our role in the world has been about being women and standing shoulder to shoulder with other women and all of these things. I have a very real fear that many of the benefits and advances made for women in terms of equality and equality of opportunity are going to be pushed back by this. However, for me, as a writer and a carer, essentially 2021 will be what 2020 was supposed to be, because everything has gone this year. But I'm lucky, again, I'm sorry to keep saying it, but because I live in this world at the moment, and it's where we're all thinking about it and theatre and all the rest of it, a lot of projects have been cancelled and won't come back. Yes. So I'm in a position where everything that I was doing this year, all my foreign translations, all my travelling, all the theatre, potentially the television, all of these things will now just happen next year. Okay. The thing that has been a challenge is that I am sociable and I balance my... I usually do sort of 18 months of head down writing and only really do, you know, my caring responsibilities and the Women's Prize around that. And then I have 6 to 8 glorious months when I'm out and about.
I miss them desperately. But we have to remind ourselves that life has changed and that matters differently, doesn't it? But it's that human connection. I think that human connection a lot of women are missing. I think bizarrely, and it might be, totally the wrong thing to say, but men are coping better potentially in lockdown because they're enjoying the downtime, whereas women are wanting more of the uptime.
Well, and I think also, you know, if all the surveys are to be credited, and it's of course hard to know, is it looks as if the balance of childcare and domestic responsibilities is hugely falling on women if they're in a partnership. And so I'm sure men are enjoying the downtime. I'm not sure a lot of women have got any downtime. For me, it's not that, actually, because my husband and I are here together and our adult children were home for the first 2 bits of lockdown. And that was an unexpected joy. You don't expect to have your grown-up children home, all of us together. And that was fabulous. Time. The only problem was it felt like we're on holiday all the time, because that's when we're all together, when we go on holiday twice a year together still. But I think for me, it was more that the way that I recharge my batteries and prepare for the next novel is being on tour and doing all my research and reading when I'm on tour. So I'm promoting one book whilst I'm preparing to write the next one. So I live in that environment. This time it was essentially, well, I should be writing book 3, but I'm not ready to write book 3 because I haven't done all of that research yet. So that's really been the thing. I've been writing a lot of journalism. There's a book coming out called Dear NHS, which Adam Kay has put together. 100 of us have written pieces for that, and all the proceeds are going to the NHS. Mm-hmm. So I've written a lot of journalism and, I suppose, reflective nonfiction. Yes. For newspapers and magazines. Yeah, my novel writing brain has not kicked in yet.
That's interesting. And that's good for us to hear as well, because everyone's thinking, why are we not being really creative? And why haven't we painted this? And why haven't we done that? But I think we're all coping and struggling and suffering in lots of other ways. And I think we have to be kind to ourselves, don't we? And that's what we're doing. Exactly. So, no, it's fascinating. Exactly. And you've had great reviews. We'll go back to your Burning Chambers. There's been some fabulous ones. And we've talked about The Climate, which was brilliant. Now, you touched on your previous trilogy of Historical Courage, Betrayal, Loyalty, and Love, and that time was set in 1942 wartime with Citadel and Labyrinth. And you know, you said that had done well in a modest way. I mean, it sold multi-million selling. I mean, what an honor. How does that feel when you know what you're passionate about is what other people are inspired and passionate about too? That must be a lovely feeling.
That's a lovely way of putting it, Nikki. It is absolutely surreal when it happens. So most of us write our books and we hope that your mum is going to read it and the people who love you will read it. And it is incredibly exciting, the idea of seeing it in a bookshop. Most people don't have enormously high expectation when their first big book goes out there. And with Labyrinth, I've been working on it for a long time because I had a full-time job. And, and I was, the executive director of Chichester Festival Theatre. And that, the thing about theatre is you have the day job, which is the executive side of things. And then, of course, the real work of the theatre happens at night. So these are long days, you know. And so I've been working on it, quietly, and then left the theatre in order to right, this is going to happen. I've got to do this. Otherwise, this book will never be written. Funnily enough, it went on, as you know, as you so nicely said, to sell millions and millions and millions of copies. And the whole trilogy has sold about 8 million copies now, which is a wonderful figure. But when it came out, it published in the UK on 7/7, the day when the big bombing atrocities happened in London. And I didn't even know anything had happened because phones were not quite as omnipresent as they are now. And I got off the train coming up from Chichester to go for my publication day. And when I arrived at the publishers, they said, how are you here? And so my publication day was spent shut down in my publisher's office. A publication book does not matter in those circumstances at all. But little by little, oddly, booksellers were telling people about this book. And at the end of the first week, it was at number 10 in the hardback bestseller list. Okay. In that environment, and that is the chart that I have framed, because that felt the most incredible thing. Yes. The idea that it would do any better than that, I'd never expected it to go into the chart at all. So for me, it was that moment, actually, and saying, it's gone into the chart. But it was that, genuinely that moment. And also standing with my children, who, you know, were obviously children at that stage, in our local Tesco's in Bognor, when it came out in paperback, and it being number one in the paperback chart in Bognor and Tesco's. And that also felt like a thing.
Oh, definitely, that is a thing. You know, very proud, and so you should be, quite rightly. And lovely that the word of mouth of, you know, the booksellers and the librarians and all the people behind the scenes spreading that word and that having that success story for you. So that's a lovely story to hear too. Thank you. Now, you talked about playwriting. It was Syrinx, yes, was your first play commissioned by Sandy Toksvig.
The first play was, I wrote it. Sandy set up a series of live theatre to be performed live on television. So her idea was the television idea, and she asked four of her friends to write plays, and we did.
Lovely. That was on Sky. And at the moment, you did have one that was going to be in 2020, didn't you?
Yes, it's The Taxidermist's Daughter, which is when I first, my caring responsibilities got, my parents lived here also. So we had a multi-generational household, but as my father's illness got more extreme, he had Parkinson's, and therefore it was daily care, everybody, you know, being involved in that. It meant that I couldn't travel. Taxidermist's Daughter in part came out of that because it's set in Fishbourne, which is where we grew up and where one of my sisters lives. The other one lives a village the other side of me. We're all still here, which is a wonderful thing. So it was returning to my childhood roots, because obviously every day I could walk in that landscape. I couldn't be in France or doing my historical fiction, but I could still be writing here.
Yes.
Which is why I had a big gap between Citadel and then publishing The Burning Chambers in this big new series.
So you've woven your life through the landscapes of time and, you know, put amongst your primary responsibilities, haven't you, which is amazing. And I know you've got the Queen of Jerusalem planned for 2022, so at least you're planning ahead, which none of us are anymore in terms of
well, it's much harder for my husband, who is a playwright, produces his own work, does sort of boutique theatre, if you like, in sort of all sorts, some in theatres, but some in sort of church halls and all of this, very much local work. And it's fantastic, very popular and very powerful. But he can't plan anything. British theatre is the most powerful soft power in economics and influence and culture that this country has. We are world leaders.
Definitely.
And the theatre industry is being destroyed.
We're missing it. I mean, it should be opening with the cinemas, really, shouldn't it? Immediately, you know, people are missing it. And I'm sure we can sit social distance apart. And I think it's sadly missed.
And several theatres have already gone bankrupt, and many more will as each week goes by. It's incredibly important. But for me, because Taxidermist's Daughter is on at Chichester and it will be on next year, and Queen of Jerusalem, you know, that they have a home to go to. Yes. They might not happen when we thought they would. But again, it's very important to just keep thinking, yes, but they haven't gone, because a lot of theatre work in particular, and, you know, several of my writer friends have had book projects cancelled because publishing, all of these things, and many of your listeners, and of course you too, Nikki, you know, nobody really knows what this new world is going to look like.
Oh, no, lots of creatives and actors and people that had plays to be staged, and it's heartbreaking, because it takes such a lot of work and effort and love, doesn't it, to get those things to happen. So I hope, yes, your husband brings that back joyfully because we all want to celebrate it. Now, you were awarded an OBE in 2013 for services to literature and women and named Woman of the Year for service to the arts in the Every Woman Awards. I mean, you are one woman championing women and that's brilliant, isn't it? And as you say, we all need to pull together and do more of that, even more of that for next year. And you're the founder director of the Women's Prize for Fiction, the largest annual celebration of women's writing in the world. How did that come about?
We're celebrating our 25th year, and we should have awarded the 25th winner in June, which is when we always do it, but we have delayed until September. I suspect that the ceremony and the readings and everything will be different this year. But there are benefits to that, as well as the sadness of not all being in the same space and having a party and raising a glass together. In that, one of the things that I think has been very powerful about what's come out of lockdown in terms of technology, provided we can make sure that everybody can have access to technology, and we forget that a lot of people don't have that, is a really interesting challenge for the Women's Prize, that we've been running a campaign called Reading Women all of this summer, which has been about all the previous books. We have a judge this year, Scarlett Curtis, who was attended to the first ever Women's Prize for Fiction in her mother's stomach. Wow. So she was not born, and she's now one of our judges. And of course, so therefore she hasn't read the earlier books. So it was the idea of sort of a generation of the Women's Prize. But the idea came about because in 1991, there was an all-male shortlist for the Booker Prize. That is actually all right, in that the judges do have the right to choose the books that they value the most and most fit with the criteria of the prize they're judging. However, nobody noticed that it was all men. And several of us said, can you imagine if they put out a list of all women? Everybody would have cried foul. They would have said it was political. They would have said it was feminism gone mad. Nobody would have said, well, that these are just the books we like the best. And it reveals that what was always this old idea that literature is written by white men and everything else, women's writings is over there and writing by black people and people of color is over there. And, you know, our choice was, I think in any situation in life, if you can see that there is a clear unfairness or a clear problem, and it is a problem if women's work is not being honored and celebrated at the same level or seen as literature.
And 25 years ago, you know, was a huge thing. You know, you were ahead of the curve. And actually, some of the women used to write in men's names on purpose, didn't they? Which doesn't happen anymore, presumably.
Well, some do. Some do use male pen names. I mean, most famously, J.K. Rowling, her crime books are written as Robert Galbraith. And quite a lot of women do use initials because they want their work to be seen as universal. So there are parts of the world where a woman picking up a pen is still seen as radical or dangerous or disallowed. But with us 25 years ago, it wasn't that there was a problem of women being published, or at least certain sorts of women being published, you know, working class women, disabled women, black women, people of color. Again, there was much less opportunity, but it was more that it wasn't seen as valuable. It wasn't being honored. That is what keeps books on the shelf. That's what keeps books available for the next generation of girls and women and boys and men to find. So it does matter.
And you've got, you know, that fabulous the way of giving other women a voice by the work that you do and the platform that you have. So, you know, that is very recognized and appreciated by women out there, which is brilliant. Yes. So which strong women or men have inspired you then?
Well, it's a terrible cliche to say this, but I would say my mother and father in the first instance, that they were my mother was very dynamic. My father was very gentle. They spent all of their free time doing things locally, community, the sense that you should put things back in, that it wasn't about making money. It wasn't about, you know, beating everybody else or being the most successful or this. It was about living and working and melding those two things together. They both had fewer opportunities because of the war. You know, my mother would have had very different opportunities if she'd been born in my time. But as it was, she had to leave school as soon as she could and earn money to help support a family.
They had those good values that are now so important in terms of giving back to the community. And obviously you do that with Chichester and theatre and arts and pay it forward in that way.
And I definitely, you know, and I always remember that our house was always filled with people stuffing envelopes or, you know, setting up jumble sales to raise money. And, you know, so I grew up in that. So I admire them both very much indeed. And that makes a great deal of difference. And I admire my mother-in-law enormously. You know, she had, you know, grew up around here as well, but very different sort of life. Her sort of a rural working class background. And because she was clever and passed the 11 plus, that actually changed her opportunities and all of those things. And she's, you know, had a lot of challenges in her life, but is just still wakes up every morning happy to see the day. So, you know, I think quite often the people that are most inspiring are the people that are closest to us. You don't necessarily know that at the time. Mm. But then, of course, when you look further afield, there are so many women I admire, so many men I admire. And I admire people who have the courage of their convictions, do things rather than just talk about it.
That's brilliant. Your passions, I mean, do you have any time to do anything else in between caring and writing? I should imagine not.
Yes. You know, I love... you will have realized from all the things I've said, you know, I'm very, very close to my family. We're all local. We're all here. So that is very, you know, wonderful. Being with friends, I very much like a glass of champagne, and I see no reason for that to be a special occasion thing. I love, you won't be surprised to know, walking and being outside in the woods, on the shore. One of the joys of lockdown is I've, you know, been able to have a proper walk every day. And once then you could do more walks, I could do longer walks.
It's good. And it does make you feel good, doesn't it? We're looking better and feeling better, even if it's not quite right. So have you got a mantra for living your life then, in terms of a sentence, a motto?
No, I would never think of it in those terms. But I suppose if I was asked to define it, I would say try and live every day as if it's your last. You know, make every day count. A lot of life is spent... people, you know, waiting for the weekend, waiting for the summer holiday, waiting to retire, waiting for to win the lottery, waiting for your book to go to number one, you know, all of these things. And waiting is a very negative thing often. Patience is a good virtue, I think, but waiting, that idea that any moment now, it will all be perfect because this thing will happen. I think for a lot of women that might be around weight or what they look like. You know, we know these things. And I think that if we can all get ourselves into a state of mind where, you know, make each day count. Don't wish your life away. Just try and make today a good day. And then tomorrow, a good day. Yeah. And soon enough, you know, and if you have a horrible day, know that my son, our son is an actor in musical theatre. He's currently playing Marius in Les Mis. And there's a lovely line in that about even, you know, the sun will rise after the darkest day. And I always think, you know, that is a good way to live. And I think also something you said right at the beginning, Nikki, about be kind to yourself. Because if you're kind to yourself, you can be kind to others. And that isn't about being selfish. That's not about putting yourself before other people. That's not what I feel at all. But I think, as you said, there are a lot of the time, women in particular feel they should be more this or less that. They should have been learning how to bake soda bread or whatever it is, you know, whatever. And the idea that, you know, just living well, that is enough.
Definitely. And those days, you know, that and everyone's having those dark days, just being, it's okay to be vulnerable. And it's okay to not be okay and know, as you say, that tomorrow or tonight or whatever will be different.
And know that emotions, you know, I think it's what all of us, if we're parents, say to our children, which is that life isn't a steady progress up to some nirvana where it's all perfect for the rest of time. You know, life is a mess of emotions and they go up and down. And the troubling emotions are as much a part of a full life as the joyous ones.
They are. And that's what we learn from it. That's what I was thinking yesterday, actually. I was thinking I couldn't lay a handle on what I was thinking and feeling. And I suddenly thought, I think it's that the nation is grieving. And as a woman and being having empathy of thinking it makes you sad to see other people sad. And everyone is sad in some way. And I thought, yes, that's what it is. It's the nation is grieving and we have to process that. So that made me feel better, actually. When I woke up this morning, I thought, that's it.
And also, I think, you know, it's it is a very different experience being locked down if you have a garden compared to if you don't. It's very different being locked down if you're in a happy relationship with either a partner or children or indoors or whatever compared to not. And it's also very, very, very different for people who've been locked down on their own.
Yes, definitely. And we must be mindful of those. And actually, you know, it's a good opportunity to say on this podcast, you know, to people that are feeling alone or you know, in very difficult relationships, to talk to someone and to seek help with whatever they're going through. So your next goal and what you would say to influence women or men listening out there, because we've got men that love our show as well. They want to know why we're influential. What would we say to them to keep them cheerful in lockdown, motivate them to write a book and go forward?
One of the things that Women's Prize has launched, which we announced back in March before any of us had an idea of what was just round the corner, but it's called Discoveries. And it is a writing program absolutely intended to increase opportunity and access for all types of women to find their way into print, because there is a great deal of difficulty, if you like, if everybody who gets into print are white middle-class women who've got contacts in the industry and know how to do it. What we're doing is we as readers are missing out on amazing voices that don't have that access. So Discoveries is absolutely supposed to say to all women, pick up your pen. And we're running it in association with Curtis Brown, the literary agency. And it will be it's a mentoring program, and people can submit the first three chapters of a novel. They've got to be unpublished writers. And we're actively wanting to reach out to Black writers, writers of colour, disabled writers, writers, older women. I'm afraid the gentleman listening, it's not for you. This is for women, obviously, being the Women's Prize. But again, so that is one of the things. And I obviously have written some tips and advice to go with that. You can go onto our website or the Curtis Brown website. But what I think is really important about writing, anybody, man or woman listening now or supporting somebody who wants to write, is this. But I don't sit down and think, I'm going to write a book of 150,000 words. I sit down and write the first sentence. So a word after a word makes a sentence after a sentence makes a paragraph after a paragraph makes a chapter. So I think what's really important with writing is having your head, your eyes down on the page or the screen, however you're doing it, small incremental steps. Don't think of the whole. Don't have your eyes up on the horizon about, you know, what it's going to be like to see this big book in a shop. Think of, does this sentence work? And then write another one. And the other thing I think is really important for writers is to take away the fear of the blank page. So 5 minutes writing a day is better than no minutes writing a day. And everybody, whoever they are, has got time for 5 minutes writing a day. You might not have time to write the novel you want to write for all the reasons that we've talked about in this podcast, but you can have a pad and paper by the kettle. And when the kettle is boiling, you can describe the steam. So it's exactly like anything else. You cannot play Beethoven's Emperor Concerto unless you have done your scales every day for many, many, many years. So with writing, people often forget that all of us work on our text. It doesn't come out. This isn't what you start with. You start with a whole load of nonsense and you're picking your way through it and trying to work out what story you are trying to tell. So if you write every day a tiny bit, just a description, or, you know, anybody when they've listened to this podcast could go away and write a description of your voice, Nikki, or my voice, or then just write how they imagine the background behind us is when we were having this conversation between us. So write the stuff that doesn't matter so that by the time you've got the time to write the thing that does matter to you, you're fit for writing.
It's similar to radio. You know, it's the time in the driving seat and putting the hours in and getting the feeling behind it. No, that's brilliant. And is that the same for fiction and non-fiction? Because I'm a bit of a frustrated budding non-fiction writer.
It is the same. And also, I think that there are obviously very different disciplines in some respects, even for very research-heavy fiction like I write. So the research process for me and for you would be quite similar as fiction and non-fiction writers. It's just with fiction, you then can decide what you're going to use and what you're not. With nonfiction, you have a project and a responsibility. You know, if you're writing a book about the history of Chichester Cathedral, say, then you can't decide that you're not going to bother about the 15th century because it won't be a history of Chichester Cathedral. Whereas I can decide to write a novel set in Chichester Cathedral and decide that the 15th century is not of interest to me.
So you start with the landscape, then you do characters, do you, and then plot last?
No, I always know the sort of story that I'm going to tell. So with The Burning Chambers, I knew that it was going to be a story that would be a love affair between a Catholic girl and a Huguenot boy. I knew that she would be the sort of woman that she was going to be, Minou Joubert, my lead character. I knew that her characteristics, I knew that their personal story and the feud between two families that was going to last, which would be around a relic and a stolen relic. I knew that their personal story would be set against the backdrop of real history. I know the real history. So if you like the architecture or the skeleton of a novel, a Kate Moss novel, I know, but I have no idea. And I know the sort of characters that are going to help me tell a story, but I don't know what they're going to do and how we're going to get there.
Really?
Until I start. But for me, that's because, and this is my third piece of advice to everybody, my first draft is all emotion. It's like, okay, I've got the stage set. I think I know the sort of characters that I'm going to meet on this journey. So let's see what I get. Let's just start. So the first draft for me is all emotion, just getting it all down on the page. Wow. I don't go back. I just get it down. Using yet another sort of metaphor, it's the house. You can buy a house, but until you've bought the house and you've got the roof and the walls and the rooms and the doors, you have no idea whether that's going to be a bedroom or a study, what color you're going to paint it, all the rest of it. You have to have something before you start to make it personal. So for me, the first draft is just get something down, and then I go back and impose structure on it. And I realize that this character isn't quite doing what I need. And as I write, Minou Joubert, who's my lead character in The Burning Chambers, she goes from being a girl woman of 19 who is the daughter of a bookseller who is a Catholic who lives in Carcassonne to being Minou. But I don't impose that on the outside. I start writing.
And you don't write by character. You literally write by chapter and it all comes out. Yeah. Fascinating.
The fourth piece of advice for everybody. So the third piece is to get something down. There are too many people who have a great idea and they never get beyond chapter three because they're so worried about chapter one not being good enough. They don't keep going. Get something down. Yeah. Don't be an editor when you're being a writer. Don't be a critic on your own shoulder. Yeah. Get it down. Then you go back and make it good. That's the real work of writing is in the editing and the rewriting, not the writing. So my second draft is all intellect and structure. And my third draft is a combination of the two. So I do three drafts of all of my books. It's a lot of work and a lot goes in the bin.
And you must back up your computer. And should people self-publish, find an agent, find a friend, come to you or enter competition?
I think the final piece of advice I would say is that everything about writing, whatever the genre, is about finding what suits you and doing it. So I am a very, very early in the day person and I write very, very early in the day. But I simply have no creative brain left after about 2 o'clock. You know, that's not my time. I have friends who don't start writing till 6 in the evening and work through the night. There are many people who will find going on a creative writing course will be brilliant because it will give them permission to take their own writing seriously. Others would find it annoying because they don't want to share until they're ready to share. There are many different ways of helping your book to get out there. There are lots of very, very, very brilliant schemes that you can, you know, creative writing courses, the weekends, weeks, going to do a master's, all of these sort of things. There are some very good reputable agencies. The one that I would always recommend is the Literary Consultancy. The director is a woman called Aki Schultz, and they are made up of professionals. Their entire job is to help create and bring on new writing and writing voices. Self-publication is a great route for some people. For others, they're not as entrepreneurial, so don't want to have to do it all themselves. The one thing is, for anybody listening, any organization that asks you to give them money, not going on a writing course, that's a different thing, but says, I will publish your book if you give me money, don't do that, because they do not have your best interests at heart. And it is about finding your voice and being edited. So I would advise absolutely going to an agency, but do your homework. It's the same with your book, Nikki, and my fiction. Do your research, but write first.
Thank you so much to you, Kate, for your time and inspiration on historical fiction and beyond and way beyond and all sorts of writer tips and how to cope in lockdown. Good luck with the next 4 books and stage plays when theatre reopens, and good luck with your family with their theatre endeavours. And lovely to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time, Kate. This influential women's podcast is co-founded and host-presented by exec producer Nikki Bannerman and award-winning Juliet Nichols, and this episode is produced by Saffron Mirza. Please subscribe for free, keep listening for more podcast guests and our 3 years of back catalogue on our channel on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify and your usual podcasting platforms. And if you love what we do, join our tribe.